Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So Katie, you were at the correspondence dinner last night. What was it like?
Well, we had something very surprising happen, something no one saw coming in politics, even in these tumultuous times, which was Theresa May was funny. She cracked a few jokes and people actually laughed. So this is, I think, the UK press lobby's attempt to mimic the US here when they do the White House correspondence dinner. And there you have, back in the day, Barack Obama. I think Donald Trump boycotts it. And we had Theresa May give a speech. And she did kind of specialise in self-deprecating humour. She made the point that she joked that, you know, this was her ideal night in a boozy club, talking to lots of journalists, because she has famously said no bars. But I think in general, the feeling you got from the event was that she kind of regained her confidence, perhaps, or she seemed to this frail prime minister who we've kind of heard depicted in the press and in The Spectator and by us on this podcast, appeared to be beginning to get a mojo, perhaps not her mojo back, because I don't know if she necessarily had one, but she looked confident in her role and seemed to almost be enjoying it.
I remember when she had to pull out of the, she pulled out of the Spectator Parliamentarian of the Year Awards speech because of that was the night the Defence Secretary resigned, Michael Fallon resigned. And I remember one of her staff lamenting to me afterwards that she'd had to pull out, because they said, look, the thing that she was going to do in that speech was show that she wasn't scarred by what went wrong at the conference speech, that she had some jokes about how all that had gone, it had gone totally disastrously, and that they felt it was going to show that she had a sense of humour about this, that she was treating those two imposters, triumph and disaster, just the same. And I think that, you know, I mean, last night, I think she went away. It is not her natural setting, as she herself admitted, as Katie said. But I think the kind of the delivering a fluent speech like that with some decent gags in it just is a way of saying, look, I am actually enjoying this. I'm not sitting in Downing Street utterly miserable.
And we also had one other star of the show. They weren't actually there. They were so important. But Theresa May made a joke about our very own James Forsyth on this podcast, where she talked about the different apps that would be useful to her government now that we had the Matt Hancock app. And one app she said would be useful to some cabinet ministers, she didn't mention who that they would be an app that automatically transposes what is said at cabinet into a James Forsyth column. So you don't have to bother actually with James having to, you know, briefing to James and then him writing it up. Until the app is available, I think the best thing to do is probably subscribe to The Spectator, and I'm sure you'll get details of that at the end of the podcast.
Quite right. James, Tony Blair's also going to be making a speech today. What's he expected to say?
So he's going to Brussels, and I think if you are looking at this campaign to reverse Brexit, you know, you saw John Major yesterday, Tony Blair today, this Blair leg is the most important, because he is going and saying to the EU, look, if you want the UK to stay, you've got to make them a better offer. And indeed, if you look at every other time the EU has asked a country to vote again on a treaty, it has come back with some quite significant concessions to make voting again more palatable and to address the arguments that drove the initial no vote. You know, so the Danes, after they rejected Maastricht, they got four opt-outs, most notably from the single currency. After the Irish voted no to Nice because they were worried about how a common and foreign security policy would affect Irish neutrality, they got kind of explicit written guarantees that it wouldn't. After they voted against the Lisbon Treaty, they got assurances that this wasn't going to affect Ireland's corporation tax rate or Irish abortion laws, you know, two things that have been big issues in the campaign there. And so I think this is right. If you do want to try and get the British public to turn against Brexit, far better than trying to threaten them and say, oh, you know, you can't survive out there in this cold world on your own, would be to say, look, we've listened to what you said. Here is something that addresses the concerns that drove the outvote. Now, I don't think the EU is at all likely to do that, because I sense very little appetite in Brussels to come back with a better offer to keep one of, if not the most awkward members of a club in. I also think free movement is such a fundamental principle for them, that one of the four freedoms, that I don't think they could come up with something that would satisfy British voters but wouldn't go against their own theology. And then finally, I think the other thing they would worry about is if you were to give the UK a bunch of concessions after voting out and then ask them to vote again, is would you encourage a kind of domino effect or a copycat effect where other Eurosceptic countries say, look, let's have a referendum, let's vote to leave, and then let's wait for Brussels to come back with the better offer. So I think for all those reasons, a big offer to the UK of a kind that might actually flip the Brexit result round is highly unlikely. And for that reason, I don't mean this campaign to overturn Brexit is going to succeed, because when I look at the John Major speech yesterday, it's a speech that you almost could, and he pretty much did, deliver before the referendum, before the last referendum. There aren't any new facts in it. And indeed, he has to concede that economically things have been better than people thought they would be straight if we voted out.
Katie, just finally, yesterday a lot of the headlines were about the Irish question. Have there been any more developments on that?
Well, I think it's just, we saw yesterday, obviously there's this draft text on the EU treaty, which is proposing that the third option, if they don't manage to find an alternative to, you know, having to do a hard border, would be to avoid that by making sure Northern Ireland stayed within the customs union and the single market. That's obviously completely intolerable to the UK government. And I think what was really interesting at PMQs yesterday was the hardening of the language by Theresa May on that. I was speaking to a DUP MP yesterday. They likened it to a letter to Santa, basically, of what the EU were doing, and said there was no way they would listen to that. And they also said they were glad for what Theresa May had said, but ultimately said they had been consulted earlier in the week by the government, because this time the government had finally learnt the lesson from the first stage of the negotiations, which is, do check. Don't mess with the DUP, check with them, because they will pull the rug from you if you don't listen. But I think what it does mark is, because Theresa May cannot back down on the issue of Northern Ireland staying and having a different arrangement to the rest of the United Kingdom, because she is very firm that she will not accept a customs union, it does mean that you are marching up a hill where either the Brussels has to back down, or you're going to see people walking away from their talks. And I don't think we've got any closer really to knowing what exactly will happen there.
I think the fundamental problem here is, because the UK government has been so slack about preparing for no deal, there is a kind of sense that the UK won't walk away, so you can push it. And actually, you probably do need the threat to, like, look, if you really want to push this, we will walk out. You need a credible threat to be able to do that, to actually get to some accommodation. Because I think the economic research actually produced by I think I'm right in saying the EU itself shows that I think Ireland would be even more affected by a no-deal Brexit than the UK would. And so you actually need to get to a point where the Irish have an interest in saying, look, actually, let's come to an accommodation. Let's look seriously at some of these technological solutions. You know, let's not rule out automatic number plate recognition cameras as being part of the deal. All that kind of stuff. And that actually requires people to think, hang on a second, do we really want to collapse the talks over this? But obviously the UK doesn't look serious in any threat to say that no deal is a bad deal, because it has put so little effort into preparing for no deal at the moment.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And while we wait for this app to be developed, if you want to subscribe to The Spectator, go to spectator.co.uk/subscribe.